making all the weird bodily noises you want to make now.
Oh, that's not a good idea for me.
Mike, any bodily noise you want to make, just make it.
I don't want to make them.
Well, you know, but you reach a certain age and a man just starts making bodily noises. Or a woman. You never know.
I'm definitely at that age.
Hi, we are Buddies in Space. You are?
S. Michael Smith, and you are?
M. Eichel Carassi, and we are joined by?
Paul Craffey.
Paul Craffey. Yeah, it's a hard one. It's a hard one to do.
Okay, we'll take it slow. Paul.
Uh-huh.
Craffey.
Well, he's S. Michael Smith. I'm M. Eichel Carassi because I make fun of him.
So what's your middle initial, Paul?
M.
All right.
Paul M. Carassi? M. Paul Carassi?
You're not pronouncing it right.
I'm tired.
How much
too.
Have you had to drink, sir?
I had so much bubble tea. Oh my god, I am smashed right now.
I think you're wasted at this point, right?
Well, it's all that teaching, you know, teaching someone how to use a cell
phone.
Oh,
you've been
all
teaching?
Day. Yeah.
Oh wow. You
yeah. A... All day.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
All day.
A lot of hours, I guess. Huh?
So many hours of teaching.
Wow.
Oh
wow.
My god, my student, forget about it. Doesn't know how to juggle calls on his phone. Oh god.
Gee, I don't even think I know how to do that.
Well, he'll teach you. Paul will teach you really well.
Yeah, we had a rather intense 24 hours, right?
Yeah, you've logged about 9 hours of like dedicated cell phone training.
Yeah.
Lessons in the last since you got in yesterday afternoon. You're holding up good.
Yeah, well, you know, listen, for a young guy, that's what I do, you know.
Yeah, just north of 30, right? You're the youngest one in the room.
Uh-huh.
So you're about to hit a major milestone.
I am. I'm about to hit the big 8-0.
8-0.
That's right.
Doesn't seem like it, right?
No.
Yeah, he's surprised.
I hope.
Now you guys.
I hope I'm in this good of shape when I'm there. Yeah.
I don't want any patronizing here. Come on.
No,
I
mean, I'm not kidding. I'm not. Yeah.
Smike is in worse shape at his age, which is nowhere close to you. He's in worse shape than you are, and he's significantly younger.
Okay. All right.
Just he has random phantom aches and pains. Not phantom.
I'm not complaining that much.
Well, I'm in denial about that. I'm in denial about pain.
I think there's something to be said about that.
Pain, no pain, no gain.
If you don't admit it's there. Right. I'm not in pain because I don't admit it's there. So
I mean I was a mess today because I spent the weekend cleaning up all the sticks and branches from our rather large yard.
Yeah, full it's of massive.
Lots and lots of trees.
Full of sticks and branches.
Yeah, and it was there was not a big storm, but a short, very intense storm that came through the weekend prior to this one, and it knocked down lots of branches, and it was a mess, and it took me hours, and then I washed my car and waxed it yesterday. So
all that stretching. Were you in a bikini?
You'll never know.
All of my mental images are just lost now. So we
and I'm a mess today, but you know I there's a little bit of denial too, and I feel like you know as things have not been getting better as I've been getting older, but I think it's a kind of it's gradual enough that it doesn't seem terrible.
Yeah, one of the good things about that is you know it's taken almost 80 years to get to where I'm at, so. But I think one of the advantages of that is that you do get to see the big picture. You just really do, because when that much time goes by, you have a whole different perspective on things. And it's interesting how it kind of creeps up on you and you realize, well, wait a minute, this is the fourth act. There's no question about that.
Is that like Taco Bell's fourth meal? That's probably different. So we're going to have to get to some celebrity stories at some point because you have so many, but let's actually dive into who the heck you are. So Paul Craffey, how would you describe yourself?
How do I describe myself? Well, I'm a guy who's been fortunate enough to have three totally different careers. Started off as an actor and a model and got to travel the world and met a lot of interesting people.
That's a good way to start.
Yeah. Right?
I'm engaged now. I was going to totally ignore you the rest of the time, but now I'm going to listen.
Yeah, and then I segued. Fortunately, I had a good business sense, and I decided to go into business after I had a kind of a meltdown. And I went into the fashion business, and it was like my acting career. It's like the modeling. It just happened overnight. And the same thing happened when I went into the fashion business. So suddenly I'm running a company after being in a business for five weeks, you know. So
you went from modeling clothes at what point?
Well, it wasn't as simple as that. I actually formed my own production company when I was about 27 because I figured, you know, I wanted to be able to do a lot of other things besides modeling and acting. So I had a partner and we produced industrial shows and fashion shows, and we did a lot of that kind of stuff.
And you did a stint at Playboy.
I did. My first job in New York, when I had the job before I got to New York, I was hired to work for a public relations agency, Robert L. Green, and they had several accounts. And their main big thing was that he was the fashion director of Playboy magazine.
Huh.
So I got to meet all those people, and all the great writers were writing.
So did you meet Hugh Hefner?
I never met him. Spoke to him on the phone, but I never met him.
Oh, okay.
I didn't actually. It's a long short story, but I didn't stay in that job for that long. What happened was we were doing a big promotion, and one of the models didn't show up, and they ended up using me, and I ended up going into that business after I'd only been working for them for about 6 months.
Ridiculous life. Hold on. Let's take a step back. I have to call you on something.
Yeah.
Fashion designer for Playboy. Are you picking up, Smike, on how that seems oxymoronic?
Well,
isn't it a magazine where all the chicks are naked?
No, they had there actually was a section of men's fashions in Playboy magazine.
Wow, this is long before I ever came across.
And this
Playboy.
This was back in this was around 1840, I think.
Okay, right. So all the women had the one piece bathing suit that was all wool.
Right. But no, actually, it was 1960, really, which is a long time ago,
So there were scantily clad or naked women and then men's fashion.
Right.
In the same magazine. And I know some really good writing.
It was a men's magazine. I mean, it was like all the stuff about, you know, being a man.
Exactly. And all the best.
It was. You got this weird expression, but that's what it was.
And all the great, Norman Mailer wrote for the magazine. All the great writers. Right up and down the line. Everybody wanted to write for the magazine because it was, for its time, I mean, it was way ahead of its time.
Right.
Not just because of the nudity, but the whole political point of view that he took, and it was very interesting as well.
But I feel like over time they really narrowed their scope to just one aspect.
Right. Well, right? Yeah. What happened was, as it moved along, as we all know, things changed a lot. We had a musical on Broadway called Hair, and everybody was nude, so it suddenly became commonplace. So
everybody's naked.
You know, didn't matter anymore. So it. I think it's amazing, really, that they've been able to hang on as long as they have, you know.
Well, they just, I think Playboy just, is this month, is featuring their first transgendered model.
Right, right.
So they're actually really still very forward thinking.
They also, you know, they had the Playboy clubs, you know, that was a very popular thing as well. And that was, and there's a lot of, he was way ahead of his time in terms of branding and all of that. That was, they were kind of way ahead of the curve on all of that.
You know? Now, since Mr. Hefner passed away very recently. Mm-hmm. There's been it was in the news, and I felt like there were voices on two sides of this. You know, there was one group that was saying that what he did was very demeaning,
exploitative,
to women,
and
exploitative. and there's another side that was saying, well, he actually was advancing a lot of women's rights issues while this was going on. So I feel like there's kind of a mixed bag or mixed set of opinions about how that happened.
Yeah, there is. But you know, I think fundamentally he really loved women. I mean,
he really loved women. Know, the guy was just all about women.
He was. And, you know, it was a very interesting time to be a part of that, even though I wasn't with it that long. But we had on Sundays, Robert L. Green, who was the owner of the agency and the fashion director, he had a townhouse in Turtle Bay, and on Sundays it was everybody that was in town would come there and pass through for brunch, and it was like was amazing. I mean, everybody wanted to be a part of it. Everybody wanted to be on the bandwagon.
Like all of his clients?
Yeah. And well, not just clients, but, you know, anybody that was in a show or coming in to do a television show. It was really an amazing thing. And I was just, you know, I was right out of college. I was really...
You're just basic, think of all that?
I mean, I was basically his gopher. I mean, that's what my job was, you know.
Turtle Bay is in near the Bronx?
It's in Midtown Manhattan, the 40s, 40, 49, 48, 49.
Is a bay there?
It's called Turtle Bay. Don't ask me how it got that name. Okay. But that section of a lot of famous people lived there. Katharine Hepburn had a house there, and a lot of people had homes there.
Was that along the park?
No.
No, 40s is below the park.
Okay.
Yeah, it was close to the UN.
Okay.
And it really was a section. It's a relatively small section. It was between 2nd and 3rd Avenue, and these were all townhouses, and it was called Turtle Bay, yeah.
Weird. So, okay, I derailed you. So you became a model, started your own production company.
Right.
This is all in New York City.
All in New York City, yeah.
And then, when did you switch into modeling and start your own production company?
Well, I did that at the same time. I was modeling and doing all
right,
of that.
Right, what year? Like?
We're talking 1960. It would have been 1961 to 1970.
Okay, so a good 10-year stretch there.
Yeah. Okay. And, well, what happened, very candidly, I had a lot of success, and the more success I was having, the harder it was to deal with it. And I was self-medicating with, you know, alcohol and recreational drugs. Yeah. But in my case, I had a total meltdown, which probably was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. So I actually left the business when I was recovering from that and ended up going into the fashion business. And I was hired kind of like an acting job, really. I was hired to go on the road, and I was a designer line of clothes, and I would go into specialty stores and do fashion shows and take orders on the clothes. It was a high-end thing.
It wasn't like a cold sell thing. It was like they would book you.
Right.
Man.
Okay. It wasn't cold sell.
He wouldn't go and be like, do you like my clothes? You can buy them.
No. So you weren't actually designing...
No, represented a designer. The first company I worked for was Malcolm Starr. They were a big deal in the 60s. And they had several divisions, and I was hired for the newest division, and I would go to specialty stores and take orders, and I would travel with the line, you know, the designer line, and take orders on it, and then we would make the clothes and send them to them.
So it's funny, you hear the phrase designer line, but I never thought about it actually like being in a box or something that you would like roll in and be like, hey, here's the whole designer line. Do you like it? You want to carry it in a store? I guess you would do that, right?
Yeah, it still exists, but it was really in its heyday in those days.
Okay.
It's, you know, lifestyles have changed a lot, so it's not quite that way anymore. I mean, there are still people doing it, but it's much smaller. It's not the same thing. So the interesting thing was that I was only doing it for about 6 or 8 weeks, and the man who had hired me for this division was made a vice president of the whole company, over the umbrella of the entire company, and they brought a woman in to run that division, and she was there for about 2 weeks and got very ill. So they brought me in from the road and didn't tell me that I was running a division, but I would get in at like an acting gig. I'd get in at 6:30 in the morning, and they would prep me until 9 o'clock, and then leave me alone and come back at the end of the day. So right away, I got this kind of, you know, it was like I was this guy who was suddenly in the business, and I don't know, anyway. So I had a career in that, and some of my things were successful, some of them weren't. The last job I had was fabulous. It was my own boss. I took a company that was really failing, and this company was totally computerized in 1979. They were in the travel business, and they had backed a designer to the tune of several million dollars, and they were really losing a lot of money. And I never thought I'd get the job, but you had to do an analysis of what you would do to turn it around, and I got the job, and it was great because I had to leave the business after that because I was my own boss. They left me alone. Nobody bothered me.
They ruined jobs for you.
It was a plum. I could never work for anybody after that. So that's when that phase was over, and I turned it around. They were very happy about it. They didn't want to be in that business. They told me to keep my office as long as I wanted to. And I'd always been fascinated by antiques. I was brought up in New England, and we had a lot of things in our house that were, you know, old things and antiques, and I always liked that. And I thought I always wanted to go into that business. Mm-hmm. So I opened a shop in Springfield, Massachusetts, and it got rave reviews. Everybody loved it. It was
so. This is career three now.
This is career three, okay. And this was 1982, okay. And I'd been in the fashion business from 1970 to 1982.
Okay.
That was the second act.
Right.
So the third act was starting in 82 when I opened my shop, and that was you've heard about a show, a Broadway show that everybody loved. It got great reviews, but it lost money. Well, my first shop was a disaster. It didn't make any money.
Well, yeah, and that was right around the Great Recession, or.
That's right.
I think that's, is that what we call it now? The
It was a downtime.
It was a terrible recession that right in the middle of the 80s there.
It was in the 80s. It was a very difficult time.
And for, I would think, for something that's a more luxury item like antiques, mm-hmm. probably really hard hit by something like
especially
that.
Especially in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Because it was, they were going through a big renewal thing there. And it was coming back. Because
they were an old industrial city.
Yeah,
right?
Originally they were. And actually, Springfield was the original capital of Massachusetts. A lot of people don't know that.
They think
it was Boston, but Springfield was the original capital. And the thing they were famous for was the Basketball Hall of Fame, which is there, you know. So,
huh, okay.
So it was, actually, I loved living there. I'm a New Englander originally, and I love that area. It didn't work, and I had to come back to New York and kind of regroup. And I ended up finally developing a business in New York that really worked well for me. And I got to, I had a lot of good years in that business.
And that was primarily flea markets, right?
It started off with flea markets. And then what happened was I graduated. I did all the major shows. There was a show called Pier Show. And I did shows in Florida. I did all the small shows. There were a lot of shows in New York in those years. That was the time when the antique business was really, it was big. I mean, everybody was into it. It was before lifestyles changed again, as we all know. The antique business, what happened, you know, we had the technology came in and things
and people
changed.
My age don't buy antiques.
I'm not interested in it. No, they're not.
You're kind of on the
you may want, yeah,
maybe a little bit, not little as much.
Bit. But so what's happened is that business has really, contracted a lot. And I stayed in it in 2012, and I closed it down then. And now I'm in the fourth act, and I'm picking my challenges. I pick the things I want to do.
So for you to have been successful in that business, you must, I'm assuming you must have to amass kind of an encyclopedic knowledge of everything, of all of these,
you're a walking antiques roadshow.
You see antiques roadshow, and you have to know how much what the value of things are.
The most important thing you have to have, at least I had to have, because I didn't specialize, is you have to have a good eye.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know, you have to just, and you have to find a formula that works for you that you can put together. And I was fortunate.
If I spend this much, I believe I can get this much out of it.
Right, exactly. And what happened to me was that I discovered Florida, where it became a market that I would do a lot of buying in. It was before everybody was savvy with the technology, so you could really find amazing things and make a very large profit.
And you also went to Budapest?
Yeah, Hungary.
Hungary.
I was on a trip, just on a pleasure trip to Eastern Europe, and I discovered Hungary and specifically Budapest. And at that time, it was after the Russians had left, they'd been occupied Hungary for a long time. And so the money exchange was fabulous. So I was getting five times the value of the dollar against the florin. So that went on really until 2001, 2002, when they went on the euro.
So would you go like every year?
I would go a few times a year, two or three times a year.
Buy the hell out of everything you can.
And it was very primitive because I would go on Malafia lines, which doesn't exist any longer. That was the Hungarian line. And I would travel with these enormous trunks, huge trunks. And they would never charge me overweight or anything. You know?
Well, that was a different time.
Yeah. And I would, and there was.
Hadn't figured out the weight thing used more fuel.
They just that was the way it was. I mean, in fact, they would even let me. I mean, I bought all kinds of wonderful art, and they would even let me bring it into the cabin of the plane. I mean, it was really it was unreal.
I'll take a seat for me and a seat for my painting.
But because
they're just happy to sell a ticket. At that point.
You're going or coming to our country? Sure.
But because they were antiques, the tariff was, you know, it's very low on that. So
because it didn't technically have a modern retail value. Oh,
and you couldn't take the risk of having it shipped because it meant you had to make an arrangement with a trucker from Hungary to get it to your. I mean, it was too complicated.
And it could be damaged.
You really had to. It was kind of like a sophisticated peddler's way of doing business, but it was very lucrative. Mm-hmm. It was extremely lucrative.
Huh.
Yeah.
So what did eBay do to that business?
Destroyed it. Yeah.
Really. eBay is to the antiques the way Uber is to taxis.
Exactly. It really, initially, because it was also a camaraderie business, and you mentioned earlier, Mike, about, you know, there's so much that you have to learn, and there is. It's mm-hmm. You're constantly in school. You're learning new things. But we learned from each other. There was so much camaraderie in the business. All the dealers would get together, and we would meet at the different markets, and we would talk, and we had all kinds of seminars. And it was, mm-hmm. It was the most interesting thing that I did because I couldn't wait to get out of bed every single day.
No matter what was
going on. I don't know what that's like.
I really...
I like my job. Yeah. I mean, I'm not like, woohoo!
I loved what I did. I mean, there were a lot of challenges with it because it was, you know, I had to pull this all together.
But these are people you're in competition with that you're getting together.
We were, but it was different. There was a kind of camaraderie in the business, you know. And when people came into the shows and looked, they wanted to know there was you would discuss the history and all of that. That all changed. What happened once the technology really started coming in, the last few years that I was doing it, the shows would open and everybody would come in with their phone and they just da 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 da. That's what it became.
Well, imagine by the end now it's they come in and they just look up what you're selling.
Exactly.
And be like, that's too much.
Exactly. They're not. There's very little. There isn't that interplay in the business that there was, you know.
I'm kind of a race to the lowest margin.
Exactly. Race to the lowest margin. And so I feel that I was fortunate because my timing was kind of perfect. I got out in 2012, mm-hmm. which was a great time to get out.
And it's funny, I witnessed this. So I probably should explain this earlier in the podcast. But so I know you, Paul, from when I first moved to New York City after college. I was a young kid, you know, kind of acting, waiting, kind of putzing around, not knowing what the hell I was doing. You know, I hadn't really gotten things figured out yet. And I started doing tech work on the side for a lot of older actors just mm-hmm. to build websites and stuff.
And I was one of them.
Yes. My name would just get passed around from one, like, seasoned actor to another. And I met some very interesting people that way. But, yeah, so I started working for you. And you were very much in the – I remember putting the Pier Show info on your website for you and mm-hmm. announcing it. And then – helping you get an eBay kit so you can take pictures of the stuff, and the pictures were terrible because the camera technology was shit back then. It's all over sharpened. But yeah, and then I remember when you got out a couple of years later.
Well, the thing that I was most fascinated about in the business more than anything else is I liked ephemera, and ephemera is basically paper. And I liked political paper, and I liked theater paper, and I liked film paper. So interestingly enough, it wasn't the place that I made the most money, but I just loved it. I've always was fascinated by it. I still am, actually.
You got tons of like old Marilyn Monroe magazines.
Oh yeah, I have a lot of rare things. There was an actress by the name of Lorette Taylor who was kind of legendary. Who was a theater actress, and any actor that you mentioned to from Brando to anyone, Lorette Taylor, everybody went in awe of her. She starred in a play called The Glass Menagerie,
and it's a big deal. Williams.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And so there was very little publicity on her ever. And she was
very private.
She was, well, she just, it, she was a strange.
Was she really, really unattractive and no one wanted to take her picture?
She wasn't particularly attractive. And she, but she won a Theater World Award in 1948.
Oh, wow.
And okay. So there was a color of her in that, and it's very hard to find. And I was able to find an original copy of it. And so I had things like that. And, you know, it was just an interesting, very interesting part of the business that I enjoyed. And I think that's how I became, I was not a politically, you know, savvy or that interested in politics really for a long time. But what happened that the study of that, looking at all of that, made me, I became very interested in politics. And
You looked to history and learned about the world. Wow, I feel like so many people could learn from that technique. Anyway.
Yeah. I think the thing that we all learn, and we certainly probably all know this, Mike, you know it, I'm sure you know it as well.
We'll see. see what you're going to say.
But once we, you know, all, we're constantly in school. I mean, I've been in school for the last day and a half, right?
Yeah, so pretty much nonstop.
You know, so we're always, I mean, I just, hopefully that's, to me, that's the most important thing, is always being able to learn and taking on a new challenge. And
well, you know. I think that's a personality thing. And I think, you know, you're clearly, you have that personality. You're always looking to learn new things. You thrive on discovering new things.
Yeah, your life history seems to.
And that's not the average person.
No,
especially as you get older.
Yeah, I it's interesting. I have friends. Believe it or not, I had a friend who was a mentor of mine who died at 105, and she was phenomenal. I mean, until the last year, Billy was. She had an expression that she used all the time, and she would say, "The show must go on." And this is a woman that
old enough; she might have coined that phrase.
I mean, she traveled, and she was interested, and she supported the arts.
And she—you've talked about she was surrounded by young people constantly.
Young people.
Right? I think that's.
She spoke several languages, and she never really had to work. But she was always working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had that gift, that joie de vivre, whatever you want to call it, that she always was interested in young people. She spent a lot of, and I've had many people in my life like that. That were, I mean, my parents. You know, my dad. I loved my dad. I got to know him sort of near the end of his life. We were so much alike. But his dreams were never really realized, you know. He never realized his dreams.
Every man lives in quiet desperation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Emerson or Thoreau? One of them said
Thoreau.
Thoreau.
Yeah.
That guy. Emerson. What did he ever say?
But, yeah, I think, and the thing I'm most interested in now, Mike and I were talking about that a lot today, actually. I mean, I really love mentoring young people. I like being around young people. I like trying to, you know, the challenges that young people have today are very different than the ones that we had. You know, the world is really spinning, as we all know, in a very different way than it was.
Mm-hmm.
And quickly, and there's no time. It's very difficult for children to remain children when they need to stay children until they become whatever.
Yeah, and it's difficult for us, for anybody who's an adult now, to really appreciate just how different things are. I mean, because things have, you know, we've seen things change.
So much change,
but
yeah.
But I can't comprehend what it would be like to just suddenly be born into this world now.
As a parent, that becomes very much on the forefront of your brain, but there's no answer to that. Because, like, my son was born into this, and I'm like, well, shit.
Yeah.
Because I feel like a lot of what I had as a frame of reference that I could offer as a knowing parent kind of has gone out the window as time goes on. So, and the more things change, it's like, I'm learning with you, kid, because I'm trying to figure this out with you. It's more and more as time goes on.
I don't know. I'm not a parent, but I certainly have tremendous empathy for people who are parents. And we have
me too.
Nieces and nephews. But I think the most important thing that you can do for a child is just really for that child to know that they're really loved. That they are really loved. I think.
Oh, I should stop beating my child. note to self. Hey, Siri. Oh, wait, I don't use Apple.
But no, but I think if it, you know, that one of the things that I see so much of with young people who come from, you know, backgrounds where that was not present for them, and that creates a lot of problems, I think, for a person when they don't really feel that they've been nurtured and loved, and, you know, where they, the best thing that I think a parent can do was, I guess it was done for me in some way, was to kind of build with some solid brick and mortar, you know, to try to give a child that kind of,
and they give it foundation.
Foundation, yeah. and discipline. I mean, the kind of world that these children are going to have to deal with is is very different than even the one you guys have to deal with.
Yeah. I remember, I'm just at the age, just at the cusp. There's actually a just came out a couple months ago, there's new research about this sub-generation called Xennials or Zennials, mm-hmm. where it's like the 6-year stretch that Erica and I fall in, where we're technically too young to be Gen X, but we're really too old to be millennials. Mm-hmm. And we remember before everything. We remember before our 24-hour TV, remember before the internet, remember before cell phones. So you take those three things out of the equation, the world's very different.
So, I thought that was just Gen Y. Is that...
Gen Y and millennials, same thing. That was millennials.
I can't keep track of these.
But
things.
Think about this these for labels. A second, guys, and it's really, I remember in the year 2000 and 2001, I had a cell phone that was an Ericsson that was this big long thing, and all it did.
See, same thing.
You're showing me, okay.
Yeah, millennials or Gen Y, it's the same thing.
All right.
All that phone did was make a call and receive a call, and that was in 2001. That's all it did, and it was a great big thing like this.
Yeah.
And we're in 2017, and I mean, it's incredible.
And today I got you on podcasts on your phone, I got you.
It is mind-boggling, and this is...
We have a new subscriber, by the way. To Buddies in Space.
Well, yeah, the cell phone today can do...
It's a computer.
It's more than a computer was back in 2000.
Yeah, that's true.
And think about this. What will it be in 5 years from now?
We devote a lot of time to that. Our podcast is very... When we're not bogged down in politics, because we're very like-minded, we talk a lot about technology. We're both, I think, technophile. It would be a fair phrase for both of us to some degree. And somewhat differently, too, which is nice. So we have somewhat divergent interests, somewhat overlapping. But yeah, like, we argue a lot about what the next thing is. Like, is it going to be virtual reality? Is it going to be augmented reality?
I still think virtual reality is just going to be, I don't know.
Flash in the pan?
A flash in the pan.
But I agree with you. Did I disagree with you at some point on
now,
that?
No, pardon my ignorance. What is virtual reality?
Oh, I don't have my cardboard down here. So... I'll show you a picture. So virtual reality, and it's actually the same virtual reality that was around 15 years ago that didn't catch on, but they're coming back. But it's basically goggles that you wear that can augment or completely generate a world that is at least somewhat lifelike, but it's all virtual.
Uh-huh.
So you put these goggles on,
yeah.
And you wear them,
yeah.
And you have controllers, you can interact with the world, but it's all what's in front of your face. And it could be, it's three-dimensional, and you could look around, and it moves with you.
So it's
I'll show you cardboard tomorrow.
So is that an advanced example of when we used to watch the first 3D movies, and we would wear the glasses? Is that kind of a...
It's like that, the many generations later version of that, I guess.
Okay.
more like an advanced version of a ViewMaster.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
There you go. There you
oh,
go.
Very good. Nice. I remember ViewMasters.
Yeah, I remember
too, actually.
Yeah.
So you just, but the crazy thing is the phones are so powerful now that you can slip them into that and they can become the virtual reality. And you have lenses and you just look around. It's really trippy. I still
feel like it's so isolating that it's not, I mean, you'll never ever, I shouldn't say that, but not anytime soon.
Careful with your predilections.
You'll never have that sense of like, I'm in.
The world.
I'm a person in this world.
Yeah.
Like, you see movies about this sort of thing, and it's like the person feels like they're really...
There's tactile, haptic feedback and all that.
They feel like they can touch things and smell things, and that's so far off to be ridiculous still.
Yeah. You don't think that's going to fly?
No. Well, the Hollywood take on virtual reality is pretty ridiculous. There are ways of using augmented reality, which is like overlays.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. So like you're seeing what's around you, but maybe an image isn't. Yeah. So the Pokemon Go was like that. Yeah. That whole craze.
Yeah.
So like you hold your phone up and the camera, you're looking at what's in front of you, but the camera is getting the real world and then mm-hmm. the phone's inserting something extra. Mm-hmm. So you could like, I could be watching you live, but there's like little animals on your head or something. Mm-hmm. That's augmented reality. Mm-hmm. That has had some more useful applications as a, you know, the cybernetic controls and medical stuff. There's more, that's where that's going.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know if I feel like I disagree with you at one point on this, but virtual reality, it seems like such a gimmick. I'm getting the Daydream because I with this phone for free, the new virtual reality headset. Mm-hmm. So we can play around with it. It comes with the controls, but I'm not looking forward to it. I'm gonna putz with it because the phone's really powerful and I get it for free, but it's like, I would have just taken the gift card. You know?
Yeah.
Some technology is just too weird for me.
Well, I think like it's like everything else. I think, you know, there has to be a balance. You know, I believe in that for myself. And I mean, I'm of an age when a lot of my friends are really, they're not good at this stuff at all.
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
I have friends who have an iPhone, and believe me, they don't know how to do anything except make and receive a phone call. And I say, why do you have an iPhone?
Your parents? How savvy are your parents?
I'm sorry?
How savvy are your parents? Because you've gotten them an iPad and all that.
Oh, not terribly, no.
Okay, so thankfully not very savvy. So you're not getting like hip chatted by them.
No.
Are they okay about it? Are they all right about it?
They are, as long as they can talk to my wife and I about, you know, if they have a problem with anything, then you know they can call.
He's
us
his parents' tech guy. He is to his parents like I am to you.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. Right. But if it were not for that, I don't think they'd want to have anything to do with it. And because we've been my wife and I, we've been the ones who have been giving them stuff, pushing them stuff.
Yeah. Here's so you iPad, introduce it to them, they don't ask this. It. They don't ask for it.
Right.
Okay, gotcha. Right. I never actually figured
and it's, that. You know, they started with, they had like this creaky desktop that my dad was using to do his taxes on. And we finally, this year, we're like, please stop using this.
It's going to collapse on
like
you.
It's like Windows 9, it's Windows XP or something.
Nice.
Or, so even like before three that, or four or 95, old. I don't know, ancient.
That's old.
It's full of virus, I'm sure.
It has all the viruses.
All the latest viruses, though. And my dad's doing taxes on it. I'm like, no.
Stop doing your most personal financial stuff on this compromised. The Russians have this computer.
So we finally got them this year to transition completely to doing stuff on an iPad. You know, we got them a keyboard that they can connect to it. We set them up with a Roku and a Google Home, and I don't think they use any of that. Oh, my dad, they like watching Longmire now. So at least
my mom can hang out with your dad.
That's the one thing that they've taken out of that side.
So oh, that's we the Netflix thing. Yeah, it's streaming. Netflix. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
do they like the Google Home?
Yeah, I don't know. I think they talk to it once in a while.
That's the thing upstairs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if it weren't for us,
they wouldn't be part.
They
of
wouldn't have anything to do with it.
Well, I think the problem with that is that then, you know, there are a lot of problems with aging anyway, with isolation for a lot of people. But that even increases the problem because they're not connected. I mean, the reality is you have to be connected or you're being left behind, you know.
So we've talked a lot about how, I find it incredibly obnoxious that every year there has to be a new phone.
It's all about marketing and money.
Well, yeah, right, but sure. my argument is if we waited every 2 years and actually had a reason to create a new phone, it would make a lot more sense. I get the financials of it, but I think from a perspective of someone who's older, it must get very intimidating very quick because you're like, oh, the iPhone 8 came out. I don't know what the iPhone 1 through 7 did, so I'm really not going to get involved in this because I'm way too out of it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Like my parents are in that same... I mean, they have iPhone 5Cs. My mom broke. She accidentally ran over her 5C last year, And they were looking all over trying to get a replacement 5C.
Good luck. Yeah, no way. Oh,
wow. I think they finally were able to. And it made sense from their perspective because they're used to using this one
thing. Yeah, that's part of the problem is getting used to things.
And then, if they could have upgraded for it, but it would have cost a little more. They probably could have afforded it.
Your parents could have afforded it.
But they didn't want to. They wanted to keep the thing that they were
comfortable with. Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of money either. I have a friend.
No, it's not for his parents.
I have a friend who's a really a very prolific. She's a writer, and she's written a lot, and very, very brilliant, smart woman. But she kind of has shut down with all of this. Mm-hmm. And she said something to me the other day I thought was interesting. She went into the Duane Reade, and Duane Reade is no longer producing their, the book they do every week where you can get coupons. Now you have to do it all online.
Yeah, Wegmans does the coupons.
And for those of you, and for people in our audience who don't know what the Duane Reade is, it's like a CVS or a Rite Aid.
Right.
But in New York. It's prolific. It's like the Starbucks of New York.
Exactly. They're on every corner. They're on every corner. And actually, Duane Reade and Walgreens have merged.
Oh, okay.
Who bought who?
Yeah. Walgreens bought Duane Reade.
That makes sense. Okay.
But I thought it was interesting because she doesn't have an iPhone and doesn't have apps and doesn't do any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And
so she has no way to check the flyer.
And, I heard her frustration on the phone, that she's frustrated by it. But that's happening with everything. It's not just, that's the way it is. We really are working toward a paperless society, except I don't know about you guys, but I get endless. If I've ever donated to anything, and I've donated a lot of, I get endless paper. I mean, it just never stops. I don't know about you, but it comes in the mail all the time.
Well, we when we do our donations, I think we don't provide our. We go through a third party.
Oh, that's smart.
Very smart. I wish I had done that. I innocently.
I think it's. I forget what it's called, but there's a.
Yeah.
I think it's called Just Give.
Huh.
Which is a website, justgive.org or .com.
So none of your information is available.
We can choose if we want to give them information. That's cool. But we did that, I think, once or twice. And then, we got all this mail. And, we're not giving our
information. Southern Poverty Law Center, is killing forests trying to get me to give again. It's like, guys, slow your roll.
I'm not going to mention names of particular charities that I've donated to, but I can't believe it, the amount of paper that comes from them.
Yeah.
It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah,
I don't know how to get rid of it. I mean,
it's like...
Just move.
Well, are you a jerk and you're like, listen, I really like the cause that you're fighting for and I'm happy to give you money, but stop mailing me.
They won't stop.
But I mean, it's just it's a weird situation to be in and be like, stop asking me to help you fight a really important fight.
Oh, yeah.
You feel like a jerk.
Because, we do that. We do that every year. We do it at a certain time, like the end of the year. Mm-hmm. We have a list of everybody that we send stuff out to.
You're like Santa Claus.
Well, just convenient that way. we don't give our we don't let them have our names anymore. Here's the money.
You still write it off, or you don't write it off?
Oh yeah, you write it off.
That's awesome, man.
But they sell these things. I mean, it's just it's incredible. But but the other thing that I've done with all of that is that you have to really do the research to see the bottom line, to see how this money's being spent.
Yeah. A website for that, too.
They do. I found that. I found the website. Yeah.
Yeah. I figured which that one is, but that's a different website from Just Give.
Yes, because I was trying to figure out how to help Puerto Rico and actually help Puerto Rico.
Yes.
And not have the money diverted to 500 other things.
That's very difficult to do.
But no, there's a website that will tell you exactly...
Well, we did that with Haiti, and I don't know... Mm. I still don't think. I mean, this problem.
Oh, Haiti. I've been to Haiti. No, I mean, not recently. But Haiti is its own sad
state of affairs.
I mean, the corruption is beyond anything you can ever imagine.
That's why you need to give to outside charity to get in. But just get, No, there's actually, I forgot what, I'll try to look it up and put it on the posting. But yeah, there is a website. It was super helpful.
I would like that website.
Sure. Yeah, they tell you exactly, this charity is, their true, their, actual, they give them a rating.
Yeah.
They are extremely honest about it, or they're extremely dishonest about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really
cool. And they rate them in different categories, their transparency and how the percentage of the money they take in goes to work
done.
And then they break down.
Yeah. And the kind of salaries and the kind of expense accounts that people have that are working. That's tough.
So two of them, I'll give a couple of charity plugs. Two of my favorite ones that we give the most to or Doctors Without Borders. Mm. They consistently always get very good ratings.
That's a good one. I know that.
And AmeriCares is another excellent one. Mm-hmm. And they do a lot of aid to foreign, wherever there's something going on, if it's another country, mm-hmm. or even if it's Puerto Rico, they did a lot of work in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
Do they do domestic
at all? I mean, I know
Puerto Rico. They're more, they do more
international province.
But yeah.
Commonwealth. What is Puerto Rico again? Relation to the U.S.? Protectorate?
Territory.
Yeah. It's all these phrases. Yeah.
They're citizens.
I know, but there's a phrase. So I forgot for the phrase for it.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I feel like half the country doesn't realize that Puerto Rico was us. It's
our country. We're just not giving them a state.
But you know, it's a sad state of affairs. I used to spend a lot of time in Puerto Rico.
They
went the way of Greece. You know, I mean, they just.
The debt.
Their debt is so was so, before this, and of course their grid was just impossible.
Archaic, right?
It's still not, you know.
Yeah, Tesla. Tesla's they're saviors with the batteries.
Right.
It's crazy, and Tesla said the government wants to rebuild their infrastructure with their batteries. They're all for it. Of course, they're going to say that they're going to make a mint on it, but it's cool. But there are pictures of people who spelled out like send Tesla in their backyards, in the floodwaters and stuff.
But it's in some ways that it's the deck was kind of stacked against Puerto Rico.
If you read up on the history of the debt, it behooves the debtors to keep that province, territory, commonwealth, protectorate, whatever they want to call it, in debt.
And not a state.
It is 100% evil megacorporation plan to keep them exactly where they are. Mm-hmm. So, and this sort of, I think, brought that to light to some degree. But.
The only problem with that, the way I see it, I'm sure you guys would agree with me, is the humanitarian situation is horrendous.
Oh, yeah.
Everything
about it is horrendous. But I mean, but what it always boils down to is, you know, people who are affluent that have to deal with situations like that come out of it fine.
Usually. So they can just leave.
Yeah.
But the they can just walk away.
Yeah, but the others can't. I mean, they
the other ones are fighting over water for their children.
It doesn't matter where it is, whether it's Puerto Rico or Houston, or it doesn't matter where it is, or New Orleans, all the things that we've seen, you know, and I don't know, and I don't want to get too political, but I just can't believe that anybody in today's world cannot see that we have a problem here with climate change. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me, but, you know.
We've spent quite a lot of
discussion
on the relative idiocracy of portions of the population.
We're about to go into our, I don't know how many mild winters we've had in a row now, but this is everybody, you know, the forecasters saying this is going to be another long, very, very
slightly
mild,
wetter,
warm
but still
winter.
Mild and warm, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's no climate change. All right, let's lighten it up a bit. So I know you always get pressed for celebrity stories, but like, do you have a celebrity story you don't get to tell very often? Cause I feel like you get asked about the same ones a lot. Cause so in your time in the industries that you were in, right. Being a performer, being a model, being producing in a production company, you've had a lot of run-ins. Like, is there one that you don't get to talk about a lot or?
There's several that I don't talk about.
I don't mean to put you on the spot for one you don't want to talk about. I'm just like, if there's a story you don't get to tell a lot, I thought I'd give you the chance.
I can tell a story about an actress that she was a model at the time. You familiar with who Lauren Hutton was? She was
really familiar.
She was the first model actually to get paid $1 million by Revlon for she was a
sponsor.
And when we were both just starting out, we used to work. There was a studio on 34th Street called Wolfhart Studios, which was kind of a really low end catalog house, but it was kind of bread and butter. Mm. You'd go there and you'd work for, at that time, I think we used to get $20 an hour, which was still a lot of money for the times. This was the early 60s. And, you know, at that time, they had all the lighting was very crude. They had all these enormous lights that they had used to set up and everything. And we were working there, And that's Lauren, yeah. And she had a pretty big career, and she was terrific gal. We used to work together. We worked together quite often. And we were doing a shoot, and one of the stands from one of these enormous lights, I don't know, it fell, and the whole thing came crashing down. And I jumped up to the ceiling, and she was like as cool as a cucumber. Didn't phase her. This woman was, she was really an interesting person. She never lost sight of her roots, and she went through a lot of changes. She made a lot of money, a tremendous sum of money, and she was living with a man who was taking care of her money and all of that, and he lost everything for her. So she had to start over again, and then she had a horrible motorcycle accident. I'm telling that story because she was kind of a quintessential survivor. You know, she's still around, she's still working. And so that's one story. That it's not a very colorful one, but it just sort of gives a little insight into the kind of my personality. I was always a reactor. You know?
She's like, eh.
Yeah, and of course, I think I've mentioned at other times that I did work with Merv Griffin on a lot of, he was just a terrific guy, terrific man. He was loved by everybody. And the reason why he was loved by everybody, because he was the kind of guy that just really was always doing favors and doing things for people. At one point, he was taking a vacation and needed someone to fill in on the, this was when the show was being done out of the little theater next to Sardi's in New York. It's before they moved to California. This was in the early 60s.
Which show?
It was the Merv Griffin, the Nighttime Show.
Okay.
And he was going on vacation, and Judy Garland, they were bringing her in to do the show for a week. And, you know, she was famous for causing a lot of problems in hotels and not paying bills. So apparently...
She was like an early child star who went
and
went
she
south,
also, right? Her career was, you know, it was very sad. But she apparently came in. We had booked her into a hotel at, it was the Hilton. And she had been there before. And this is amazing. They wouldn't let her stay.
Wow.
She had no money. And she got on a train to Subway and went out and stayed with friends of hers in Brooklyn. And they called the next day and we sent... I mean, this is the kind of guy he was. He sent her a limousine for her, brought her up, put her in the Plaza. You know, she had to get fixed and all of that. And he and Judy Garland was this, you know, big superstar, right? Well, none of the people that she knew wanted to come on the show. She was going through a rough time. And Merv had all the people that worked for him got together and put a show together, and she was terrific, and she took over for the week. But, I mean, you know, when you meet people, when you're around people like this, you know, believe me, they're not all like that. We all know how life is. But when you meet people that have that kind of sensibility and kind of care about the human condition, it has a major effect on you, you know. So I've been very fortunate in my life to be around a lot of people like that. You know, I mentioned before, you know, I knew, having a little bit of a junior moment late here at night, Ethel Merman. I met her. The first Broadway show I ever saw was Gypsy when I was in my junior year of college. Mm-hmm. And not too many years later, I meet her at a party. And she got in their cups, and the hostess wanted her out of there. And I took her home to, she lived in the Berkshire Hotel, and she sobered up right away, and she was really, she'd gone through a tough time. Again, it was a human thing. Her daughter had died of an overdose of drugs about a month before that, and she had just divorced Ernest Borgnine. She was married to him for a short time. So she was very fragile. And she treated me like a son, and we became friends, and a lot of interesting things happened. You know, she took me one night to El Morocco, which was a pretty famous nightclub in New York, and there was a man by the name of Earl Wilson, who was a very famous columnist, and everybody bowed and scraped to him, and he was celebrating 50 years in show business. So, and this defines Ethel perfectly. We're sitting at the table, we're eating, and everybody's getting up to give a tribute to Earl. Mm-hmm. And Ethel puts down her fork, takes a drink of water, and she gets up, and she does a rendition of There's No Business Like Show Business. She tore the house down. I mean, this woman was electric. You talk about someone who really had a presence.
But no prep, just takes a bite, puts it down, drink water,
and,
bang.
And she was the most unpretentious person I ever met in show business. I mean, she was a big star, but she couldn't stand anybody that was a phony. She said it exactly like it was. She was a very real, really down to earth. And she'd been a secretary before she became a star when she was pretty young. And she could take shorthand and dictation. And
which is a skill she probably didn't need much, but maybe, I don't know.
And you know, at the end of her life, she gave back. She became a hospitality woman at a hospital in New York, and she would go 3 times a week, and she would go visit patients, and that's what she did.
Wow!
For the last several years of her life, when she was no longer in show business. So,
well, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
You've talked about several women that sounds like you deeply admired, and throughout your career. And as I'm sure you've heard recently, there's been a kind of an explosion of maybe awareness about how women in the entertainment industry have been treated, kind of an open secret that is being brought to light now, especially with, you know, Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
Affleck and
a couple of others.
James Torbach, whatever his name is, yeah.
So not to put you on the spot, but did you ever see anything like this as you were, you know, working as an actor?
A lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I saw a lot of it. And truthfully, I was exposed to it as well. It wasn't just women.
Mm-hmm.
Men were vulnerable as well. Mm-hmm. I really think what this is probably going to do, because it goes into every industry. Hollywood is a classic example of it.
Right.
But I think it exists everywhere. I mean, there are problems in the tech world with this.
Yeah, I think anywhere where there's like a disparity and there's someone with so much power over other people.
You know, and
entertainment in particular.
And I think women, you know, I think it's more of a problem for women than it is for men. It's not talked about as much with men.
Okay, but to take it back to the entertainment thing.
Yeah.
So you clearly saw, like you witnessed this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, I saw a lot of it.
And it was it usually like male producers or was it directors?
It went on every level.
It was just everywhere.
It went on every level, Mike. You would see a stage manager, would hit on an actress in a play or
use their position.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily someone. It wasn't just at the top end. It was kind of the alpha male kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that all men are not like that.
Right.
But what's happened is that this what you've mentioned is this Weinstein thing has opened up a whole Pandora's box, I think, and it's finally coming out of the woodwork. And I think it's a good thing, actually.
I think you had a good point where it's not, you know, this isn't just a problem with the entertainment industry, but because the recent incidents or the news is about the entertainment industry, that's what gets so much more attention.
Mm-hmm. And we'll continue to.
Yeah, if it was like something, if the same story on Wall Street, people wouldn't be reading about it in tabloids and it wouldn't be on the news shows.
Because the players, the people involved wouldn't be as famous.
Well, there's a misconception about fame and Hollywood and all of that. There is no such thing as glamour. Glamour does not exist. Glamour is an illusion. There is no such thing. You know this, and we've talked about this before. It's boot camp. It's very hard work. You know,
Mike's more of an actor than I am.
I know like 90% of acting is just standing around waiting.
Waiting for lighting. The lighting is the real star.
Exactly. And you know, you think it's that way now, and it is. You know, in my day when I was doing it, I mean, it was endless. I mean, the time that you had to stand around and wait. One of the things that I did, the agency, the modeling agency I was with, had a contract in Detroit with the cars. I think it was General Motors that we used to go to, and they would fly us out to Detroit, which was bad in those days, and that you would stay in the hotel. And
it's bad in these days.
Bad in these days, and they would take you in an armored van, one of those vans, even then, and you would take you to they take you to the you know where the hangars where they were photographing the cars. Well, you would sit there all day, and you'd play cards. And it took them all day to get the lighting and everything.
Yeah. So are these like the magazine pictures you see?
Yeah,
like
all of that.
The silverhead fox and his nice Lexus or whatever.
Yeah, with the technology, that's a good thing now. It's not
it's faster.
Not that. Like I did a film a few years ago, a small independent film. It was called The Coalition of One. And I played the president of the Senate, and we filmed it in North Hadley, Massachusetts. Wanted to go to Washington, but didn't have the money. But it looked like Washington. And I was just fascinated because I hadn't done anything in a long time. And the young guy that was the director, when he wasn't using me, he let me be behind the camera. Well, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, first of all, the setups are minimal for the most part now. And it's all in the camera, and they shoot the scene. And if they feel they've got that scene, well, they play it back, and they got
the daily,
it, and they move on.
No more dailies. It's
so
right
no more
there.
Dailies.
Yeah, no
it's all it's one, two, three. It's one, two,
well,
three.
Well, portrait mode on your iPhone. The technology's all there, man. That shit gets done.
It's
so
all
it gets
there.
Fixed so quick.
And people are making films now with their iPhones.
Yeah.
And they're having success with it.
The whole Matrix effect was done with just point and shoot, or not point and shoot, but SLR cameras. Like,
yeah.
The technology in an individual piece of electronics now is just so far ahead.
So far ahead. So you do a lot of acting. You didn't even...
Well, some. Certainly not a lot.
He does more stage acting. I mean, he does stage acting now, and you've done plenty of acting.
I have. Yeah. I've been taking it easier lately. But
What kind of things do you enjoy doing when you're live theater?
Yeah.
Have you done any commercials? I forget.
No, I never got into the commercials.
Such an easy gig.
Easy's relative.
Well, it's today it's a big numbers game.
Yeah.
And if you're not a celebrity,
you
know, if it's so much of it is celebrity driven now.
But you did a play last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was called The Language Archive. It was I've done mostly by far comedy roles.
Mm-hmm.
And last year I was very fortunate to get a part that was it was a lead in a. It was a comedy, but it was also very emotional. And it was, you know, the first time I'd ever done intentionally a scene that made people in the audience cry. And that kind of I'd never really done anything on that side of the emotional
spectrum.
Mm-hmm. And it was a big challenge for me, and but it was also very rewarding because I was able to connect to the audience in a way that I had never been able to before. Mm-hmm. I just hadn't had a chance to.
Yeah, you get the itch every couple of years, right?
Yeah, that's enough.
So that's your passion, but you also have your passion for your tech work and all that, right?
Yeah.
I think your passion is taking it easy. Enjoying life, right?
Why not? That's a good passion to have. Yeah.
I definitely have the drive to get out there and to get on stage, but I don't know if it's just my personality because I'm normally a very introverted person. Like doing one show every year or two is enough. And I can go back and recharge and then another year or so later, I'm like, okay, I'm ready to do this again. Let's go.
Did you know a lot of people in the industry? Like, I've known people like Smike, like comedians in particular, especially like this. Because we've had multiple comedians when I was in New York, who big name comedians who were going to perform with us and then chickened out.
What?
Oh, yeah. Louis Black, Jim Gaffigan. Because we were in a very prominent club in New York. We had really big names performing upstairs, and they knew the people who were running the troupe I was in, and they'd be like, "Yeah, so Jim wants to come perform," and then he'd chicken out. And it turns out that they're very introverted in real life.
Yeah, they
and
are.
The difference between doing stand up and improv, pretty huge about opening yourself up and surrendering control.
A lot of vulnerability.
So did you know a lot of people who were like actually very introverted but had a very big persona?
I did.
Pretty common.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, I think some of the most interesting actors, I say actors, whether it's male or female, have that quality that they're able to project something totally different than what they are.
He does it very well.
I'm sure you do that.
I think Dustin Hoffman's like the classic example of that.
Yeah, he's a classic example of he's an actor's actor, and Al Pacino I think is another example of that.
But he wasn't as private. Well, was he as private a person?
I don't know. I think De Niro is.
De Niro is probably a better example of that. Yeah. Yeah. I tell you, someone else who he's not so private, but I think he's a terrifically versatile actor is Alec Baldwin. I think he's so capable. I mean, so he can do comedy. He can do. Years ago, I saw him do a production of he played Stanley Kowalski against with Jessica Lange on Broadway.
Death of a Salesman.
Not Death of a Salesman.
I can't think of. I recognize the character name, but
yeah, big. It was Brando's big. Thing on Broadway.
Not True West, not a
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
No.
Streetcar Named Desire.
Streetcar Named Desire, okay. Right?
Thank you.
That's it.
It's like, it's bothering me. I know this.
It was right there. It was on the tip of my tongue.
You mentioned Tennessee Williams earlier.
Yeah, I know. I got that one right away.
But he was. Now, I've seen that role done by more than a few actors. Mm. Of course, Brando was the definitive guy. Yeah. But he was fabulous. I mean, he was really good in that role. That was, you know, he's great at comedy. He's great at drama. He can play really pretty much anything.
Role. I don't think he gets recognized for it as much, which he said he doesn't. Himself. He gets really annoyed.
He doesn't. He doesn't do that much.
He was going to retire because he's like, no one's ever going to give me an Oscar. I'm just going to give up. But then Trump got elected, and he's like, interesting. I found a new thing to do.
Yeah, that was interesting.
It was sad that it wasn't him who was Hillary's. For the person, remember how we were speculating it was him?
Yeah.
Who she was practicing against?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't him. Because there was a mystery person playing Trump.
Oh, right.
For her
right.
To debate against and practices. Yeah. And we're like, it's got to be Baldwin. He's got to be doing it for her. But it wasn't.
Well, he won several awards for 30 Rock, didn't he?
Yeah, but he won. Television. He was chasing the.
Yeah, the Academy. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Paul, it's late. We're well over an hour. This has been awesome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. It's been great meeting you and great meeting
certainly.
You. Really great.
You are?
That's Michael Smith, and you are?
And Michael Crossy, and you are?
I am Paul Creffy.
All right. Yeah, it just doesn't work. We are Buddies in Space.
Buddies in Space is a Stolen Dress Entertainment production. Visit StolenDress.com to check out other Stolen Dress podcasts, blogs, tweets, videos, and books.
It's past your bedtime, sir.
Uh-huh.